Hello and welcome to another episode of GDPR Now, a podcast dedicated to all things related to data security and data privacy, brought to you by Data Protection for Business, and this is DPO. Your host today is me, Karen Heaton, owner of Data Protection for Business, still recording from my home office in Southwest London. This episode is part of our series of podcasts addressing security and privacy concerns resulting from the coronavirus pandemic and the shift in working practices for millions of businesses across the UK and the world. In today's episode, we are delving into the issues we discussed in our previous episode, number 24, on the NHS Track and Trace app, and we're going to consider in more detail the legal, privacy and practicality barriers that we talked about. We're also going to discuss what this means in practice for these apps as future solutions when we need to help governments manage pandemics. So on our show today, I'm delighted to welcome Mark Sherwood-Edwards and Roger Marlowe, both experts in their respective fields. Mark is a fellow GDPR Now host, leading lawyer in technology and fintech, and founder of Clearview Legal. Mark has kindly agreed to join us today in our search for app enlightenment. Mark, welcome.
Good to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Also on our show today, we welcome Roger Marlowe. Roger's a software professional with extensive experience in software projects, including banking, defence, automotive, as well as 10 years in the NHS. As Roger has his own software company, which provides IT services into the NHS, he's also in a unique position to give us a benefit of his government-based experience. And you can often find Roger, who writes regularly for Toby Young's Lockdown Skeptics website. So welcome, Roger. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Karen. Good to be on the show.
Yeah, you're welcome. So, quick summary then. In our last episode, that was episode 24, we talked about the NHS Track and Trace app. We did a quick summary of how did we get here, what the difference was between the Apple and Google solution and the original NHSX solution that was built. We talked about some of the practical challenges of any app, regardless of who's built it. Problems from battery life, being able to see through walls, transmitting signals in train carriages, the size of the data sets, etc. And then we really delved into some of the privacy issues around, well, who do you trust more with your data? Is it the government or is it Google or Apple? And, you know, what about the data we're collecting? How is it going to be used and how is it going to be enforced? So what we're going to do today, we're going to start with some of the legal perspectives that we just touched on in the previous episode. And what we'd discussed previously was, you know, richer data sets, for example, could they provide better or more valuable medical information, which could help not only save lives, but direct government policy. So let's kick off then. The whole issue of the legal perspective of collecting citizens' data and the legal hurdles to climb, especially if the data that's being collected doesn't appear to be providing a lot of information. Is it efficient? Are we doing the right thing in collecting this information if it's not efficient or if it's not producing meaningful results based on what it was originally intended for? So, Mark, would you be able to kick us off from the legal perspective, please?
Yeah, happy to do that. So in the previous episode, there was a comment along the lines that, and I think it came from one of the parliamentary subcommittees, that if the app wasn't effective, then it would possibly be in breach of human rights and shouldn't be deployed. Now, there's nothing explicit along those lines in the GDPR. There's nothing that says you can only collect personal data if you are achieving your purpose. So for example, if I start up a takeaway food business and I'm bad at delivery and the food is dire, I can still carry on with, from GDPR point of view, collecting data. I think that where the only real way you could introduce is it efficient as a kind of legal point is if it turned out that it was particularly the kind of collection of the data was particularly intrusive and B, it was very clear it was having no effect, then possibly you could build an argument around fairness, because one of the principles of GDPR and has been a principle of data protection, about 20, 30 years, collection and use has to be fair and transparent for that matter. But I think it's quite hard to run the argument now on the basis that, no one quite knows what works yet. It's been tried and tested. This is version 1.0. Maybe by the time we get to version 2.0, it'll be working much better.
So, yeah, Roger, I think you had mentioned that this had been brought up in Parliament, this particular issue, and this statement that had been made to the subcommittees.
That's right. So Harriet Harman's Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights had said just that. So they put it to Matt Hancock that they'd said that unless the efficacy and benefits were clear, then the level of data being collected will not be justifiable. And I mean, there's a few things behind that. One was that back then, that the amount of data that NHSX were contemplating collecting was quite different to what actually turned out to be collected in the end. So they were going to be quite ambitious. They were all sorts of location data, possibly more demographic data, more health data. So they were talking about it as a more complete picture of the end user. And in fact, what transpired was a really stripped down data model. There's very little data actually moving around or stored on the phone, either in the design that was contemplated by NHSX or by the Apple Google model, which they eventually moved to. In fact, I think the data really just reduces down to a Bluetooth received signal strength indicator, a time of day, and a random string of bits to identify some security certificate. That's about it. So there's almost nothing in the data that's being passed around. And so in some ways, the discussion that was going on between the kind of NHS management and the parliamentarians was a bit disconnected from technologically what was actually going on the ground.
So that the stripping down of the data set that's occurred, do we think this was as a result of some of the privacy concerns raised, perhaps once additional work was done on things like the data protection impact assessment and some of the other governance structures that were going to be put in place for the app? Do you have any views, Mark, first of all, on whether perhaps that's why the data set became so small?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think there was a lot of concern about the amount of data being collected, whether it be centralised or decentralised. And certainly there was guidance produced by both the European Commission and by the European Data Protection Board, and also by, I haven't checked the ISO specifically, but both the EU Commission and Data Protection Board said there shouldn't be location data there, there should just be proximity data there. And that's a reduction of data. And it may have, who knows whether that proximity, that location data would have been useful. I don't know. You don't know what you don't know. So, and it may be that people could have spotted, hotspots of infection more easily by location. That might have prompted some more questions, which might have led to more this and that. I mean, if you think of the way that, not that I'm an expert on AI clearly at all, but it's all about how big your data set is and then let the AI do its stuff. Now, that's an ultra simplistic way of looking at things, but unless you've got the less rich the data set, the clearly the fewer insights you're going to get.
I was just going to say this is one of the things you see in the debate. So there's population level data where you could apply machine learning, AI, and mining all sorts of interesting things from population level data. And I think you're on safer grounds from a privacy point of view there, because you're not identifying individuals. The issue back in March when the design of these apps were being discussed was that they weren't really talking about population data. They were talking about trying to detect transmission from one individual to another. And so things like location was questionable, because can you tell the location of your phone down to 6 feet, which was the distance which was being talked about then. So are you within 6 feet of another person for 15 minutes, and can your phone determine its location to that level of accuracy? And you know, then that's that's quite a complicated technical problem, and that's why they ended up going with this proximity proxy, as you might call it, of signal strength. But you know, other apps around the world have tried to use GPS location, not necessarily successfully. And it's really down to your kind of mental model of how you think the virus transmits itself, and so you say, well, it's when one person is close to another for a period of time. Let's just determine their location, and when they're close to each other for a period of time, that's it. A transmission event has probably occurred, hasn't it? So that's but obviously when you talk about individuals, then you're into the realm of privacy. So I think it depends what the app is trying to achieve. If it's trying to do population level stuff, that's one thing. But if it's about individuals and their health data, then obviously that's more privacy issues.
So within the EU and countries subject to GDPR, would you say that any or many countries have used location data successfully in their app, or even used it at all?
So almost all European countries have gone for the same approach. They've ended up using the Google and Apple technology. That's, as it turns out, that's not because of location or data concerns, although the public narrative has always been about location data being stored centrally or in a distributed manner. Although in fact, in none of the apps in very few of the apps, actual location data was ever contemplated. It turned out to be a more practical reason that when the phone's in your pocket, the app goes into background mode, and then it's not allowed to access the Bluetooth hardware. And so this is one of the problems that places like Singapore and Australia ran into early on, that it worked fine when it was in the lab, constantly being prodded by the technicians who are testing it. But when the general public had hold of it and they just put their phone in their pocket, then the app became ineffective as soon as the screensaver came on. And the answer to that was Google and Apple to change their operating system to allow these apps access to Bluetooth hardware in the background. And then you could have a kind of always on app. So that's really what drove that kind of pragmatic matter, is really what drove the adoption of the Apple Google technology. Has it been successful? Well, we can get into that a bit more, but I think within Europe they've all had roughly the same kind of story. Maybe one exception, one exception being Iceland, I would say, whether you consider Iceland to be part of Europe. So Iceland, they do use GPS location tracking data in their app.
Yeah, but they're, of course, a very large country with very few people living in it. So they might have had their own issues.
So Iceland is an interesting case. So Iceland has had the highest uptake by proportion of population of any of the Western world countries. So it's had 40% of its population download their app.
So 40% is the highest uptake.
That's the highest uptake.
So this leads us again into another aspect of the legal perspective, which is in the EU we're talking about still now, generally the app has not been mandated. So Mark, what are the barriers or the bars from a data protection perspective that governments would need to consider if they were to make this a mandated app? If, for example, data and research shows that actually the coverage of this app needs to be in the realms of 70-80% of the population to make it a useful tool in combating an epidemic?
Well, it's a really good question. The short answer is I don't exactly know, but you imagine the way you would do it is you'd pass legislation in each of the member states saying we're now making this mandatory, and that would be the primary thing. And then the question is it subject to challenge under the GDPR or under the kind of human rights legislation? Now, the GDPR is kind of fairly permissive around, substantial public interest, that kind of thing. So provided you're proportionate, legitimate, defined, purpose limited, you'd be allowed to do what you want. And actually the kind of, for people interested in data protection, it's not that much different to the analysis that went on in SHREMS. So SHREMS is forget the privacy shield part of it, is to what extent can intelligence agencies grab your data and do what they want with it? And the short answer is, well, privacy is a fundamental human right, but it's not unlimited. And it can be constrained by and pushed back by state action, provided that state action is legitimate, is justified, i.e., I don't know, prevention of war, prevention of terrorism, here prevention of, you know, high number of deaths, and is suitably constrained, defined, purpose limited, so the authorities don't have carte blanche. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, if you're unhappy with what the government is doing, you can go to court and have it out in court. You've got legal recourse, so the government is subject to the rule of law. So it would be the same kind of approach here if an EU government wanted to make it mandatory.
So it's totally possible and could be enacted by the governments in the EU if they chose to do so. And so, Roger, I know that you've done some great work looking at the apps over in Asia. You know, my understanding is that a number of those that appear to have been successful in countries where they've had very low infection and death rates were mandatory. It was required that citizens had to download these apps. So, Roger, you've done a lot of work on looking at apps around the world. So do you have a view on the percentage of uptake in countries where it's mandatory versus where it isn't mandatory? I mean, what have they been doing in Asia, for example, where they've had, you know, relatively low death and infection rates?
Sure. So certainly in European countries where it's not mandatory, the governments have gone to great expense and effort to encourage the population to download the app. Most people reference a piece of work done at Oxford, actually, which reckoned that you need to reach about 56% of the general population. And given that not everybody has a phone, that means you've got to reach about 80% of smartphone users. So that actually, that piece of research is referenced by countries all around the world. If you're looking into this kind of thing, governments always talk about that level of reaching, you know, between 50 and 60%. In fact, what actually happened, because we have the data now, we can see how many people downloaded it. In fact, the UK has been in terms of large countries, it's been one of the most successful, but it's only reached 30% of the population. So it's currently at around 20 million downloads. Germany is very similar. It's also had 20 million downloads, but it's a larger country, so it's really only reached 20% of its population. The highest by percentage of population is Iceland, but that's a much, much smaller country. Spain has reached 20%. It's currently at 3.5 million downloads. They came quite late to the game. They're aiming for 9 million downloads, which will be 20%. Italy is at 14% of their population. Switzerland reached 20%. So it looks like between 20 and 30% is what you get if you just try and convince people through advertising campaigns and the government trying to convince the population that it's a great thing to use.
Which is really interesting because, you know, the impression sometimes you get in the media is that compliance in the UK is not very good. But actually, when you compare it to other European countries, it's you know, as good as
the UK is. Yes, I mean, the UK has done better than almost every other country. Germany's I suppose the closest. So that and the UK app has more functionality as well. So the UK app also has this venue check-in functionality as well, and venues have been quite good at printing out their check-in posters.
Yeah, so
there's nearly 700,000 venues now have a QR code where you can use the app to check in. I mean, that is now being it's not quite enforced through legislation, but you have to. I think I Mark, you can correct me on this if I'm wrong, but I believe you have to write down the details of all visitors to your venue if you're running a hospitality business, and you don't have to do that if people use the NHS COVID-19 app. So there's a very strong influence for people to use the app if they want to go anywhere other than their own home.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about the hospitality, but I know that shops and other places I personally have been scanning the QR codes. I quite like it when it pops up and it recognises the venue.
Yes. I don't know if people know, by the way, but the venue is not given the data. So the venue doesn't know that any of the people who checked in, that just remains on your phone. And the phone from time to time goes to the kind of server and asks, you know, have any of the venues I've checked into been determined as being risky? They're called risky venues by the NHS test and trace scheme. What's interesting about that is that the server is publicly available. So you can go and have a look at the venues which have been listed as risky. And what's interesting about that is that given that there are nearly 700,000 venues participating in the scheme and over a million check-ins a day, the number of venues that have been determined to be risky is has not been more than three in any one day. So the app was released in mid-September, and since then, I think no more than a dozen venues have been listed as risky. So if you get an alert on your phone saying that you've been in a risky venue, you're an extremely lucky person. It's probably it's probably rarer than winning the lottery, actually. So yeah.
In the previous days, we would probably be quite excited about going to a risky venue. I'm not so sure now.
Yeah.
And so in Asia, then, where there were a number of countries made it mandatory. It was touched on at the end of last episode. What was there? What was their number on the uptake score?
So, what's interesting there is you're dependent on the government telling you how many downloads have been, and because it's mandatory, they don't have to. You know, they don't have to tell you. So it's almost like a badge of honor for European countries to boast how many downloads they've had. I've searched in vain to find details for South Korea, Taiwan, Vietnam, Thailand, Pakistan, and so on. So we actually don't know. But what is very interesting about those countries is the COVID numbers are totally different. So in the UK, we're between 50,000 and 60,000 deaths since the start of the outbreak. And that's in a population of 66 million. If you look at Vietnam, that's a population of 95 million. They've had 35 deaths. Thailand is a population of 70 million. They've had 59 deaths. Taiwan, 24 million people in a very densely populated island. They've had 7 deaths. So I've, you know, seen quite a few articles where people, and actually public figures and politicians, referring to places like Taiwan and Thailand and kind of linking this very low number of deaths to the fact that they've got much more intrusive app usage. And I think, to be honest with you, that's an oversimplification because there are lots of other intrusive practices going on. But certainly the COVID statistics in those countries are startling when you compare them to European countries.
Yeah, and you know, as speaking as a layperson here, it certainly feels like if it was as simple as having an app that collected lots of data, even though people didn't like it, and very, very toughly enforcing it. I mean, if it was that simple, then we would do it, or it would have been, or it will be done in the future.
And Greece had very low levels at one point. Have they got worse since then?
Well, they're now on, you know, various travel corridors and so on, aren't they? So I don't have the statistics in front of me, but it's a really good point because although places like Vietnam and Taiwan have extremely low numbers, I think Taiwan, when I was researching this, I think they actually list the individuals on their Wikipedia page who died of COVID, and that's how small the number of people are. But the question is it all to come for them? Is it all ahead of them? So it seems, I mean, I'm, you know, straying out of my expertise with technology into, like all of us these days, becoming an armchair epidemiologist. It looks as if coronavirus is not endemic yet in those populations, whereas it is endemic now in European countries and other Western countries. And so you're just talking about a different scenario. So maybe it's all ahead of them in places like Taiwan or Vietnam. Who knows?
So it's a very, very interesting question. And maybe, as you know, it's possible there's immunity there because of previous diseases have had.
Possibly.
Obviously, yes. I'm straying very far out of my knowledge of biology with that statement, but I guess it's more in hope rather than expectation.
It does have a technology implication, by the way. So if you look at Taiwan, for example, again, they've had small numbers, so 7 deaths in Taiwan, but they do attribute their success not necessarily to an app, but to the overall technology infrastructure that they have. So they've managed to join up. They have, you know, what they would call smart cities. So they connect, you know, the telco operators with the finance people with the traveling infrastructure. And to give you an example, the famous case of the Diamond Princess cruise ship. So that visited various places in northern Taiwan, and the Taiwan smart city technology, the IEFS system, tracked over 600,000 contacts that they reckon have been in contact with people from Diamond Princess after its visits. And so and there've been other similar events. So that's only possible when it's handled in a kind of semi or fully automated system. And this has been one of the criticisms leveled at, you know, in the UK, that the test and trace infrastructure, which has a lot of people in call centers ringing people, it just cannot cope with scale once the virus has become endemic. So, you know, when you look back at places like Taiwan, where they've managed to keep the numbers really low, even when you only have, they're at the stage of, in their kind of epidemic, where the number of deaths is in single figures, it's involved tracking over 600,000 people simultaneously from one event, like a cruise ship arriving in port, for example.
And across multiple data points, data sets.
Yes.
To a level that has not been contemplated here.
Well, exactly. I mean, if you look at another example, which is South Korea, I mean, their system is quite something. It could be something out of 1984. You can go to a website that they helpfully publish called coronavap.site, and you can see individual locations where they live of people who've been diagnosed with COVID, and that's in an app that's available to anybody on the internet. If you come within 100 meters of one of those locations, you will receive a text telling you that they don't give you the name, but they do give you the gender and the age of the person and when they got their diagnosis, and they also give you the past 2 weeks of location information for that person, even though you wouldn't know this person from Adam. So that's just kind of handed over to you by the government.
So I guess what is going through my mind is, if we knew today, given all the restrictions and the economic damage and the potential for future health problems, and some of the educational damage to children, if we were offered back in April a highly automated app solution utilizing multiple data sets to be able to control the spread of the virus right at the beginning, would we have agreed to do it?
So there's several parts to the answer that I think. One of them is around, do we trust the people operating it with the data? So how comfortable would you be about people around you saying, receiving text saying a woman has just tested positive, click on a link for the places she visited before she was hospitalized? How comfortable would you be about that? Because that's what's going on in South Korea. There's also the question then of is it going to be effective? Are we going to, if we're going to give up that amount of privacy, are we going to get in return some strong guarantees on safety and on some of the other problems that happen in the long term, which is what bodies like the EU raise, such as mission creep? Do we really trust the operators of that system to do as Matt Hancock has promised, which is to withdraw the app and delete all the data when the pandemic is over? Do we trust that? Again, that's not what's going on in Taiwan, for example. They've baked it into their city infrastructure, and it's there forever, and they're claiming all sorts of other benefits from it. So, yeah.
Well, on that retention point, I mean, if you look at the privacy notice for the NHS track and trace, it talks about retention at the end, and I mean, there's two sets of data. There's data on your phone, there's data in the server, and the data on your phone gets deleted, 14 days, 28 days, whatever. That disappears quite quickly. The back-end server, there's no GDPR retention period set up because in their view it's anonymous. So they don't need to have a GDPR retention. They've got their NAPS retention periods, which are, I think they're probably required to as a government department, 20 years for some of it, but that's all kind of anonymized data. So, you know, that kind of addresses, well, that's an answer to that, whether you think that's enough or not, a separate point.
And I think, you know, that's back to the point we were making earlier about population level data versus individual data, which it seems that population level data is of some use, or highly anonymized data at a population scale is of some use. And we know that there are other apps out there which people don't think of at the same time as track and tracing apps. But things like symptom trackers have become very popular, and they're operated by private companies, and they're giving us a lot of data. And I think, Karen, you've got some...
Yeah, the Zoe COVID survey, it came out very early on, the beginning of this epidemic. It went through a couple of my WhatsApp groups, actually. And I did some research on the company behind it. Now they've got strong links to one of the top universities and bioscience company. So, you know... They have a dual interest in collecting these really rich data sets. One, obviously, in the current pandemic, and secondly, you know, that kind of health information could be used, you know, for medical science. And over 5 million people downloaded and I guess still use that app, and that's completely voluntary. And there was, you know, it just went round, as far as I could tell, through word of mouth. Question, you know, becomes is where is the governance that's over the top of that? But
yes,
people are given that data freely, you know, and so Mark, I would say, you know, question to you is, you know, here we are discussing, you know, the legality of the privacy issues around giving away data to government authorities. Yet, you know, we're locked in our homes and we've lost other basic human rights that we had before March, you know, the right to go and earn a living in some instances and socialize and visit family and friends and stuff. So it feels a little bit, you know, if I was going to be the man in the street and just say, well, you know, we might have protected our data privacy, but actually we've lost a whole load of other freedoms anyway.
Well, yeah, but what do you do if you're in the government? In the government, you're trying to, you know, get rid of or slow down COVID. On the one hand, you're not trying not to destroy the economy. No one knows exactly what is effective in slowing down COVID. Though actually, other than isolation, right? We know that if you isolate everybody, no one meets in each other. Since most of the spread is person to person, there will be less spread. Okay. How best to do that, how best to track that, how best to make it happen, no one's really quite sure. Everyone's fumbling in the dark. Mm. At the same time, it's, you know, it's damaging the economy, clearly. So, you know, and this is not a GDPR point, so, you know, I'd have said at that point some kind of restrictions are required to protect, you know, some people. It's not a solitary choice, right? It's not, in the end, that's the problem. It's not, yeah, I'm okay, I'll take the risk. You don't take the risk for yourself. You take the risk for about 50 other people you might bump into, which is kind of delegitimizes your risk taking.
I mean, there's some other kind of interesting aspects to it, which is, you know, what happens when there are faults in the system. So, you know, the UK has had some reasonably well-publicized problems. Actually, not so much with the app, although there were some problems with the app in that it won't work on older hardware because the hardware just doesn't have the necessary chipsets to give you the Bluetooth functionality. But there have been problems with the systems being used in the wider test and trace organization. So there was a, you know, very public problem where there was somewhere in the whole system, there was a spreadsheet that was being used to transfer data around. And 16,000 names just dropped off the end of that spreadsheet. So those people weren't notified about the exposures that they'd had. And there's been another one recently again, not with the app, but with systems that support the people in the call centers for contact tracing, where the system was not issuing the correct dates for the start and end of your isolation period. So it turns out that about 7,000 people were told to isolate for too long. And by the time the bug had been discovered and the people had, that it affected had been told, those people had been told to isolate in their homes for longer than was necessary, you know, under the current legislation. So, you know, technical issues in these systems have big consequences, and you know, I wonder whether there's any remedy in law or protections in law for people who, you know, are you protected if the government you know, uses these systems and you suffer because of it.
Interesting question. So you probably short answers. I don't really know. Could you bring a case of negligence or something? You know, you can go right around the road. I think your chances of succeeding or something like this would be pretty slim. Not only because there'll be some kind of crown prerogative at play, but who, you know, I mean, what I think is quite interesting is the way that the NHS track and trace app has been kind of deployed in the UK. I don't mean deployed an operational logistic way, but in a kind of legal way, how they built it, you know, what lawful basis they put it under, what they put in their privacy notice, you know, all that kind of stuff. They've obviously gone to a lot of trouble to try and get it right. They had a lot of discussions with the ICO, interaction between them and the ICO. It's all, you know, a lot of it's available there. You know, a huge DPIA of 50,000 words is available there. That the bases are available there. I mean, for those who are interested, it's, you know, you can go take a look at it. And if Karen and Roger are interested, I'll give you 3 minutes worth on it now.
Yeah, I would love to. Thank
you.
Okay, so you've got a standard privacy notice, as you might expect, and you kind of think, well, if I was going to run a track and trace app, I would, you know, what would I do? What lawful basis would I do it? Would I do it consent? It seems to be the obvious one to do it, or would I find something else? And actually, they haven't done it under consent. They've done it under Article 6.1e. Processing is necessary for the performance of a task carried out in a public interest. Okay. And the primary advantage of that, I suspect, apart from the fact it sounds a bit more legitimate, is you don't need to gather consent in the same way. You don't need specific, unambiguous consent, you know, per use that you're going to make of the data. So that's the primary one. Then they've gone under, you know, so that's a primary basis. And then they've got this special category basis, which is kind of 9.2G, H and I. And for those, you know, it's all about substantial public interest. Who knows what the difference between public interest and substantial public interest is? I have no idea. It's not in there anywhere. Then that was G. Then H is medical diagnosis, provision of health or social care, management of health or social care. And then I is another reason of public interest, areas of public health. So there's loads of stuff there.
Yeah.
And then there's a couple of references out to the DPA, management healthcare systems, public health purposes. So there's a couple of interesting points there. One is that you would not initially assume that proximity data is health data, right? So this is kind of the nature, the multifaceted nature of personal data. If I was running an app to see how close people stood together, because I'm interested in, I know I'm in that, and I want to sell, I know, breath freshener, I, you know, that would not be special category data for those purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly the same data if I'm using it to work out, I like people like to get infected, become self data. The data hasn't changed. It's just the purpose you're using data defines what the data is about. And another interesting thing is they've had to rely on the PECA, on the private, the Privacy and Electronic Communications Directive regulation, was a directive enacted as a regulation. And if you remember, it's got like cookie stuff, right?
Yes. Yeah, we remember it well.
Yeah, right. So basically the cookie, and it's all the cookie says, a person shall not gain access to information stored in the terminal of a subscriber unless, so data stored in the terminal of a subscriber, i.e. your phone, and basically it's pulling off data and matching it with other people's phones, unless you've got explicit consent or consent, or such storage or access is strictly necessary for the provision of an information society service requested by the subscriber or user. So information society service is EU speak for online service. So clearly to make this app work, you need to have access to your phone and other people's phones. So that comes within that tick there. Then you've got the tick for the lawful basis, and you're kind of off and running. And the advantage of, or the advantage or disadvantage, or one of the advantages from the consumer's point of view of the using the GDPR Article 6.1e, which is public interest, is then there's further bits in the GDPR that basically says the regulation or the law shall meet an objective of public interest and be proportionate to the legitimate aim pursued. Just a bit back to the point we're talking about, it's not unconstrained, it's going to be proportionate to what they're trying to do.
Right, okay. So those safeguards or those reasons are built in?
Well, they're built into they're there in the privacy notice. These are the lawful bases. There's effectively about four, five, six lawful bases. Which is another interesting point for privacy practitioners, where it's often, and in my view incorrectly said, you can only have one lawful basis per purpose, right? And here they've got same purpose, about six of them.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Are definitely being covered.
Yeah.
But when it has been laid out in that way with strong public health benefits, you wonder why it wasn't made mandatory.
Well, I think, you know, they didn't make it mandatory because they thought the carrot was better than it would be more effective than the stick, right? I mean, it's a tactical question, apart from the moral question. Are you more likely to get higher penetration as a voluntary thing? And does the population respect the government enough to, well, could the government to make it mandatory? And if it was made mandatory, how much policing would be required to actually enforce it? You know, and make all those things just practical things, which would make it pretty difficult.
But yes, the mandatory national lockdown we're in is, another, is a stick approach in that analogy.
Yeah. But it's kind of easier because the only way you're going to find out, and actually the mandatory is not like it's heavily policed. I know that I'm talking to some friends back from Spain recently, and if you left your village, you'd be stopped on the road by the police. And if you said what, and they said why you leave the village, they say what, and you say I'm going to get my hair cut in the next town. They say that's not good enough. There's a hairdresser in the village. Go back to the village. The lockdown's not being enforced heavily in that way. It's more a moral principle with ideas on threats in the background.
I also wonder whether they're getting the data, they're getting the utility out of it that they were originally hoping for. I mean, there was great store laid in all these apps back in March and April, and not just in the UK, but around the world, chancellors and prime ministers saying like this is the route out of lockdown. That was certainly the promise made in Australia, and in Germany there's a similar message, and it was a standard pattern that you'd have the country's leader announcing the launch of the app. It's great fanfare trying to get the numbers up, but I really wonder whether, and huge amounts of money spent on this, on advertising campaigns, and I really wonder whether they got the utility out of it they were hoping. Just to go back to Iceland as an example, one of the people involved in running that scheme there, so there's this chap called Gestur Palmason who's running the technology part of the test and trace scheme there, and Iceland's had the highest population uptake, 40%, and a quote from him is that the technology is more or less, I wouldn't say useless, but with the integration of all the other things, it's proven it's not a game changer. And he says, we've been working in a collaborative model with citizens. He says, there's law, we can do fines, but basically we can't just trust the technology. So even when you've managed to get a high uptake in your population, it's not turning out to be as effective as everyone was hoping originally. So
well, maybe it would be more effective if there was more, if you know, category, more information gathered. So this is the kind of, you know, you can look at it from a negative way, a positive way. This is the negative way, the thin end of the wedge, and you know, here comes Big Brother. Or the positive way, this is 1.0 and 2.0 would be better. So maybe more location data, maybe some smartphones could take your temperature and feed that, you know, automatically. Yeah.
I mean, quite possibly. Just kind of, you know, just thinking outside the box a little bit now. So maybe, you know, maybe an actually custom-made device. So this is what they did in Singapore. So Singapore failed with its app because low-paid workers didn't have the phones, and all the transmission was happening amongst low-paid workers. So the 40,000 immigrant workers living in dormitories, it didn't have smartphones and therefore couldn't use an app. So what the Singaporean government did was it actually manufactured a device that you could just wear on your lapel. It just clipped on to your lapel, and it just had just the hardware in there that was necessary that they needed. And so they'd gone for that approach, and they just give it out. Yeah. So I mean, that would be another approach. So if you had something which maybe had, you know, a thermometer in it, and maybe some, you know, whatever you thought was necessary to get the right data, I mean, that's a completely different approach. As Karen was saying earlier, the citizen science approach, where, you know, people are encouraged just to volunteer their data, that seems to have yielded a lot more data than the government dared to collect because of privacy concerns. So I think if you were a company developing this as a product, I think it probably still wouldn't have come out of the research labs yet. You'd still be iterating through, you know, version 2, version 3, version 4. Unfortunately, because all of this has been done necessarily in a rush, starting from nothing, you have to do this iteration in the public eye, you know, while the pandemic is still ongoing. And so you just don't have the time to kind of go through all these kind of product pivots to try and find the most effective approach.
Yeah, it's totally correct. And also, you know, a point we sort of ended on in the previous episode was around, well, how do we have the debate to decide how intrusive an app should be based on the level of risk of a particular virus. So, you know, you could imagine a scenario where if another virus came in and it was much more deadly than coronavirus, that actually if there was some mechanism for saying, right, everybody, you know, this is the way it's going to be for the next year, it's going to be this app, it's going to be mandatory, and it's going to be collecting all this data because, you know, this is a different situation we've learned from the past situation.
Yeah.
But how could we even get to that point of being able to calibrate a response?
I mean, I think it's difficult. I mean, just to frame it in a slightly different way, just to put some perspective on it, if you look at causes of death in the UK in September, so COVID-19 was 19th on the list with 690 deaths in September. Road accidents were 130 deaths. So it's you're not an order of magnitude away from road accidents. Now, your phone, I don't know if you know this, but your phone, if you have an Apple phone, certainly the core motion feature on there has a good guess at what activity you're up to. So it can tell whether you're walking, stationary, seated, going upstairs, but it can also tell whether you're in a motor vehicle or not. So one, you know, you could it'd be pretty straightforward for Apple to alert you when it said, hey, I think you're driving a car. Do you know that that's a risky activity? Now, how would people react to that? I mean, you get some very strange looks if your phone tried to warn you that you're driving every time you got in your car. But so back in September, the numbers of deaths were, you know, in the same kind of ballpark as COVID deaths, and yet we were jumping through all these hoops, privacy hoops, and technological issues and political problems with the COVID app, and yet, you know, your phone can also tell you that you're in a car which has a similar level of risk.
There is some, I don't know if either of you have heard, there is some really good news on the horizon from the testing point. Now, my daughter brought this to my attention, actually. She's doing chemistry GCSE. And it's quite controversial. So, Mark, I don't know if you have a view on this, but... So this involves a lady called Jennifer Doudna. She's an American biochemist. She was awarded the 2020 Nobel Prize in Chemistry together with a chap called Emmanuel Charpentier. And they're both known for their pioneering work in CRISPR gene editing. Now, CRISPR is a technology that can be used to edit genes. And here we go. This is my summary of my understanding of it. It's a way of finding a specific bit of DNA inside a cell, which they can then alter that piece of DNA or turn the genes on or off without altering their sequence. So they've developed this highly accurate COVID test using this technology that takes 5 minutes and, importantly, doesn't require expensive lab equipment, so it can be used in many different settings. You know, it's come out in the last couple of months. They're obviously working quite hard on it. But again, we might end up with the same dilemma. Here is a incredibly efficient test that can be done really quickly, that could be rolled out quickly, that could, you know, in the case of an incredibly dangerous epidemic, could help stop it. However, it's going to have to collect and process genetic data.
But it comes back, I mean, I think the point, but it comes back to how much you trust the state and the organisations, right? So if you look at the UK, so on the whole, we trust our governments, on the whole, we trust the ICO. And the ICO has actually pulled in the police force, right? Pulled them up. Do you remember on that, the Welsh... facial recognition. So the ICO will intervene. And I know that in Australia, the police tried to get hold of some track and trace data, and they refused permission to do that. And, you know, provided that stuff is robust enough, then, and particularly if you can't have genome, So there are other advantages, presumably, right? If you map everybody's genome. I mean, that may, you know, we know that NHS costs, again, here's an armchair medical strategist, right?
Yes.
I know that medically, we all know that NHS costs are higher and higher, aging population, so on. How do you make medicine, how do you increase the health of everybody without increasing the cost of doing so? Maybe if we had universal genome mapping, that would be a good way of going there. And even if you made it voluntary and people said, well, actually, you know, you'll probably end up living 5 years longer because you'll catch things earlier, a lot of people would sign up for it.
Yes, I mean, now,
aren't they? The interesting conversations.
We're getting into some issues which were running, you know, before the COVID outbreak, and so the NHS, because it is a unified system, well, at some level anyway, it does have access to these almost unique data sets, you know, these whole population data sets, which other health systems don't have access to. And there were debates about, you know, what use should the NHS put these population data sets to, and then you get into the question of, okay, who's getting access to it? So is Big Pharma getting access to it? Are they making the right use of it? Who's making money out of it? Who's getting the benefits? So there are the health benefits, but obviously there are the financial benefits as well. So that's another kind of very complex area. And it's only the data sets are only going to get more and more with the use of apps like this. I mean, there's another, just kind of on the kind of population level data, back to the individual level stuff. I'm also wondering, to what extent can the law be enforced around things which happen on your phone? So if if the app tells you to isolate and if there are penalties and legal sanctions around isolation, can that be tied back to something that just happened on your phone? I mean, I know there are issues around, so for example, you currently, if you're on a low income and somebody from Test and Trace calls you, so if a real person calls you and tells you to isolate and you're on a low income, you can claim £500 from your local authority to support you in your isolation. But you can't claim it if you've just been alerted by the phone. So are there issues around, you know, to what extent are sanctions and the law enforceable when it's just down to an app on your phone?
Well, good question. I don't see why the sanctions wouldn't be enforceable. I mean, there's a more GDPR-ish point around automated decision making. So GDPR as a piece of legislation is not that keen on automated decision making, doesn't like it, think it's kind of disenfranchises the population, that kind of stuff. And actually it's dealt with and then it's just track and trace. And they say, well, actually we don't think it applies. Actually, interesting, the Commission and the ED, the European Data Protection Board, said no, you shouldn't be, there should be no automatic decision making. Everyone should be notified by a human being if they're likely to have got infection, which clearly in my view is nonsense. Because who's, you know, that just increases cost, time, all that kind of stuff. So the NHS Track and Trace says we've reviewed it, we don't think it applies, but anyway, we're going to comply. And I think the way they comply is they tell you that you may have been infected, you come into contact with someone who's been infected. If you want to talk to someone, here's a number, rather than actually calling you.
Right. There's the intervention.
Yeah, exactly. So I think all this kind of stuff is much more to do with the practicality. It's a bit like getting people monitoring seatbelts, right? Occasionally you catch people who are not wearing the seatbelts, but it's quite hard to do if you're a police person. You don't particularly like, well, it's easy to do now because everyone accepts it. Equally, quite hard to catch people when they're on their phones in the cars. Now, as a practical matter, it's hard to catch them, but it's easier to do now because everyone understands the logic behind it.
Yeah, that's totally correct. Well, crikey, what a podcast we've had. Lots of great points being raised and discussed. And I think, you know, we've covered a lot of areas. From my perspective, I think what I find fascinating is that we are at a point where privacy is, it's a big deal in our lives, and it's very pertinent in the teeth of a pandemic, because it impacts and it needs to be considered seriously alongside our policy actions and the things that people do.
Yes, I'm sure that's right. And it's not an issue that's going away. And I don't think we've got the answer yet. So I think this is going to go through many more iterations before we get to something where, you know, it's generally accepted and everybody's comfortable with it and understands how it all works. I think we're still right at the start of that process of working out how best to handle it without having to reinvent our culture.
I agree. Mark, any comment?
No, I agree with that. I think it's a trade-off, isn't it? What we thought were important freedoms, you realise important is a relative term. And, you know, it's not just about your safety, but safety of your family, safety of your neighbours and so on. So you have to be a certain amount, at least where I take it, a certain amount of community thinking is required. And although, you know, the UK, well, the West compared to the East has got a much stronger individualist tradition, it may be that in increasing globalisation, you know, climate change, to take an example, shows that actually that the world has become too small for that to be sustainable the way it was back in the medieval ages.
Well, those are fights that the younger generation will be are taking on.
I count myself in that group.
Yeah, well, sorry, all of us are finding ourselves in that group, of course. Well, in summary, let this younger generation on our show today summarise what we've talked about. in our show, we talked about some of the barriers from data protection regulations in the EU around the quantity and quality of the data that apps can collect and whether this has actually reduced the effectiveness of the track and trace apps. We've heard that more successful apps in Asia, for example, collected more data and combined this with other data sets to better target infections quickly. These countries have undeniably had a less severe impact from coronavirus. So what price for data privacy? You know, when many basic freedoms have been taken from us and our way of life severely impacted over the course of 2020, what if we had taken a different approach and used more data and made the apps mandatory? Could the outcomes have been different? What if 80% app usage is realistically needed to be effective? If so, then why did we not do this? And what are we to learn from other countries? A bugbear of mine is when I hear people, including politicians, quoting the success in Asia without mentioning the quantity of data collected or even that the app is mandatory. I think that's, you know, that's just not fair. They're hiding some of the truths of this. So we must continue this conversation, I think, all of us, together with the younger generation, and find a framework for discussing the greater use of data in a mandatory way to support better pandemic and health outcomes. I personally truly believe there are solutions out there without restricting the amount of data we have to use. We just need to organise ourselves better to discuss them. And unfortunately, the damage to the UK economy is real, and the UK's national debt, for example, I looked the other day, is now the highest since the Second World War. So this is not a projection based on academic modelling. It's an actual amount that has to be paid back by us, our children, and potentially their children as well. So we cannot simply afford continual damaging lockdowns when the next virus comes along, which sadly it must. So let's continue the conversation. However, unfortunately, we are at the end of this episode of GDPR Now. For listeners of any questions, please email me, or any issues, or if you'd like to appear on the podcast, please let me know. So to our listeners, thanks again for listening. But to Mark and to Roger, a huge thank you for taking the time in giving us a brilliant conversation at a very timely moment in our lives. And yeah, I really appreciate it. So that's it for me, Karen Heaton. I hope you'll join us again soon. Take care. Stay safe.